geometry, nanotechnologies, you name it, all sorts of things which are absolutely brilliant. And we ought to be feeling really excited about our nation's future rather than depressed because if we're going to get mugged by the next little corner. Yeah. I think also that there ought to be a ban on anybody who uses these words. They ought to be just thrown out. Centres of excellence. Out of the box. Joined up thinking. Leading edge. Cutting edge. Leading edge. That's when I presume you get too close to that cutting edge. And out of the box and then thinking the unthinkable. I mean, what's going on? Those words should be banned. I also hate, and I ban them even innovation and creativity. Creativity is useless, it's pointless, it is a word usually used by people who aren't creative. And having travelled the country and spoken to lots of people who write books about creativity and business, I found them the least imaginative people I've ever met. I was asked by venture capitalists when I wanted to do the Eden Project, what's your exit strategy? When a man asks you that, there's only one answer. Death. You get asked by people, your business plan just won't work because if you can't sum up what you do in one sentence, you can't create a brand. And I reply, if I could sum up what I'm about to do in one sentence, I wouldn't want to work there. All those are things you've got to bear in mind. Storytelling as well is the thing. You see, it isn't enough to ask someone for money. That's a supplicant's job. That's begging. What you need to do is to make the people you want money from fear death. Do you know what it feels like to be the guy who turned down the Beatles? Think of the shame his grandchildren. Be brave. Now, underneath all this, there is a truth that we all know. I mean, eggs. I want to talk about eggs. I mean, I want to talk about eggs. Did you know that 15 years ago you could buy eggs in supermarkets? Just eggs. Then it got very exciting. You could buy eggs from chickens that had been released from bondage. They were now in barns. You could buy barn-made eggs. Then it got so funky. You could buy eggs that not only had been laid in barns, but the chickens broke free of that and they were free range. And then it went one stage further, like free range organic. And this year, ladies and gentlemen, we can buy eggs that not only have the chickens enjoyed a liberation beyond their wildest dreams, the chickens lay their eggs into little containers that are biodegradable. How thrilling is that? Why would I mention this? I'm actually partially joking, but there's something going on here. C.S. Lewis once famously said, while science may lead you to truth, only the imagination can lead you to meaning. And it's meaning we all see in some ways. The storytelling, that's why death is important, and that's why those chickens were important. But also beware the lies in it. You've heard of dolphin-friendly tuna. Yes? Anybody here seen tuna-friendly dolphin? There's a lot of bollocks going on in all this, you know that, don't you? It's the same with the argument over organicism, same about almost every subject. We want meaning and we grab it too quickly and then we close down our critical faculties because we so badly want things to be so. I discovered a lot of things doing Eden that I didn't know I appreciate. You know, I've had more letters from people complimenting me about the quality of the binding on the bamboo handrails than the quality of the entire structure. Why would that be? Anybody who's been to Eden and has either fallen over or gone on their knees by the bamboo handrails will realise there are most beautiful carvings hidden inside. That is quite obviously, if you're an accountant, a waste of money, isn't it? If you're going to value engineer the world, you do not do beautiful carvings inside a bamboo handrail. So why is it that so many people love these things? You see, I think we're arriving at a period where the most important word over the next 15 years is going to be beauty. We're going to rediscover beauty. Because beauty will be seen to be not an extra, it will be seen as the life affirmation that there's more to life than just existence and consumption and utility. Utility is actually rather dull if it doesn't come with the romance of some hidden meaning behind it. And colour is the same. Emotional language, men are such problems. You women already know that, but I'm just helping the guys here. Because we have a language of rationality. Everything is supposed to be rational. We live in a monetized world where you can price everything. But of course you can't. That is why you should steer clear of accountants as often as you can. Because the problem with accountants is they know the cost of everything, but they do not know the cost of not doing things. Which is actually a really important point. Because if you're a gambler, and I am a gambler, if you take risks, I'm a risk taker. People who aren't either of those things, and accountants are neither, they don't understand the dynamic of risk. And for risk to work, there has to be a strange beauty in what you do. There's a logic in what I say, right? The bravest thing I have ever done, work-wise, was in 2004, in July of 2004, I knew that if we kept the same staff levels as we had at the time, we would go bust in October. And yet I had promised all my colleagues they would have jobs. What do? You make 200 people redundant? Or do you get your entire 700 staff together and say, guys, how do you fancy taking a risk? And the risk I'm going to invite you to take is we either lose 200 people, we take a risk so big, we'll all go down in flames. Which is it to be? You know what the decision was. We're going to go down in flames. Why do we go down in flames? Because the moment you made the decision to go down in flames, you're not going to go down in flames. Because the dynamic that you have created through taking the risk and the shared feeling that everybody's taking an equal risk makes it almost inevitable that the risk has now shrunk amazingly. Do you remember the first time you dumped a boyfriend or girlfriend? Do you remember the energy you put into the anticipation of how horrible it was going to be? It was much worse, wasn't it, than the moment you did do the dumping, wasn't it? To think if you had taken all that energy of anticipation out and just gone up to sunset over. So we built the biggest outdoor ice rink in Europe at Eden. Cost us £1.5 million. Everybody told me that people who built ice rinks went bust. But I knew that if we built an ice rink and told everybody we're going to go down in flames because people who build ice rinks go bust, everybody involved in the gamble would tell so many people that it was there that people would come. So in that winter when we built the ice rink, over 150,000 people came to see what kind of mad critters were building an ice rink. So what was you going to go bust? I'm saying this actually with a very serious point. That people don't understand gambling and risk-taking. All my life, at the age of 37, actually not all my life, at the age of 37 I made a decision. I'd been in the music industry. I'd had a horrible time. I'd had success. I'd written the biggest record in French history. And I was going along the Champs-Élysées. And I was going to an award ceremony. It had been number one for 15 weeks. And I burst into tears. Why did I burst into tears? I now know why I burst into tears. Because the trouble is when you want something really badly, but it's not from here, it feels like ashes. Dorothy Parker once famously said, the problem with getting there is that when you get there, there's no there there. And that was what it was about. And I decided that day that I was going to leave the music industry. It took me a few years to do it. But that when I actually made the break, I was going to gamble with my life and thought that I would do what intuition told me to do. When I go and speak to students, I say, there are two things I wish I'd known when I was 19. Two things. Well, three. The third is I wish I'd known how to talk to ladies better. But the two really serious things were, number one, not to waste a moment of your life trying to be the person that you think your parents want you to be. Because when you get to the age your parents are, you discover they didn't have a clue. So you wasted all that time. And the second thing is to trust intuition. Because if you trust your intuition, there will be millions of people like you. So the only issue is marketing, letting them know that you've got this idea. Unless you're a freak. Yeah? And most of us aren't freaks. So you've got to trust your instincts. Since the day I decided to do that, I have rolled six. Every dice has rolled six. There's something about your body language and your certainty that when you say, I'm doing this, I really feel it. I'll give you a musical analogy. If you hand someone a tape, you say, you might like that. I think it's all right. No one's bothered. You say, I adore this. People listen to it with different ears. So, we're talking about entrepreneurship. The first thing I noticed about most successful entrepreneurs is that they don't think of themselves as entrepreneurs. The only people who actually use the word entrepreneur are bankers who really want to be entrepreneurs and can't be. No, they're single language bankers. That's why I loathe bankers too. God, we'd like to invest and take a risk. We'll give you £10,000 on easy terms. Look, you fucker, easy terms is put your house on the line. Yeah? Real entrepreneurs were like Joel, you know, what a brilliant talk to the guys this morning. But real entrepreneurship is actually trusting your spirit and putting your life on the line, because the moment you've done it, it's almost certain you will succeed, because it matters. And things that matter make the blood course through your veins in different ways. When I did Helligan, I only knew green side up is what a plant is. Honestly, all I knew. But I knew I was looking at a place of such romance that I just loved the smell of it, I loved the feel of it, and I knew that if I could get to the public, they would want to come. So we did a TV documentary, and the TV documentary won awards all over the place. It's fantastic. Only one mistake, they forgot to mention we weren't open yet. We've got all these people arriving in coaches. So we ripped the toilet out of the porter room, just like the one up there. It brought back memories last night. We ripped the toilet out, and I put one of my builders in there, and he charged people to come in. It was fantastic to come in. They watched the work, and they said, what's happening around the corner? And they said, don't know, maybe here's a machete, but they don't find out. Then I made a really stupid mistake. I thought I was funny to children, because I had children myself. Right, so I said, I'll take all the school groups. They were 3 days, the most stressful days of my life. They didn't find me funny at all. They thought I was really boring, and they beat each other up, and they broke the garden up, and all this bit. Second night, I'm reading to my children, it's a Roald Dahl story, and thinking of pulling a sickie for myself for the third day. I arrived the following day, my tummy tight as a drum, and I suddenly knew what to do. I looked out at these children, and I sneered. I said, I'm going to tell you about poison. Your poisons will burn for your little stomachs. Stories about the ancient Aztecs and the drugs invented by the Aztecs to stop live human sacrifices screaming as they're still pumping hearts or being cut out of their chest cavity to be ripped out of their to be held up to celebrate the dawning of the summer solstice. At this point, I could have done anything. My parents were poor. What I learned about storytelling is everything. You can create a narrative that people want to be part of. I couldn't do almost anything, and that's what Eden was. I had this idea, people were saying, Tim, you're so visionary. Little tosh. Is there anybody in here? Oh no, is there anybody age 12 that did not dream of building either a big dam or a Mad Ludwig castle or a lost city? Like, that's what you do when you're 12. That's not visionary. The only visionary thing I had was to believe that I could find a story that would persuade 300 people professionally trained to say no to get them to say yes. And that's where I started, about death, talking to people about death, and do they want to be the guy that turned down the Beatles? So you've got to instill that fear, so suddenly we raise the money. Then you have to learn how to tell future truths. You need to be able to lie but in such a way that eventually it will look like you're telling the truth. We're in advance of the situation. The first lie I told was that the Millennium Commission, which bought half the money, they sent a fax, which they graded all the projects in grade A, grade B, grade C, and grade C was, what on earth are you thinking of? Go away. When the facts came through, Eden Project was grade C. I already had 100 people given up their jobs to work with me to build the Eden Project. You cannot, at that point, say you're not doing it, can you? So what do? You hold a press conference, don't you? You hold a press conference, the world's press comes, and you thank the Millennium Commission for their compassion. And you know what? I never lied. But the weirdest thing is that 3 months later, the Millennium Commission thought they'd given us the grant. So we got the money. Anyway, we built a large gang. I've got 5 minutes left, so I can worry about that. So we built the Eden Project, and we built it on radical conditions. We persuaded the constructors to work for nothing for a while, the architects to work for nothing for a while, and we built it on time and on budget because I said, we're going to do this innocently, and I said to the constructors, this is going to be the best project you have ever worked on. And we had lawyers' documents this big, and Colin McAlpine and I signed a letter, the most valuable letter of my life, which said, regardless of what the lawyers have said, we are not going to have any arguments, there will be no litigation, it will be built on time and on budget, and we shook hands on it. and we never looked at the contracts again, and we did build it on time and on budget. It was so good that the phase two of the project, everybody volunteered to work again for nothing until we raised the money for the next stage, because we liked working together. So when you go to an innovation conference, which I tell you is rubbish, okay, because many people talk about it, as I said before, they don't know what they're talking about. The real innovation is of the oldest of all. It is to remember trust. Trust is the vital lifeblood of success. And it's idiots who tell you you can't trust other people, because actually you use so much of your life distrusting that actually the fun of it's gone. Most good people, if you shake hands on a deal, will not betray you. And it cuts out a lot of money and it makes things fun. And if things are fun, people can see themselves as part of the narrative and part of the story, and they want to be there. So when we opened the Eden Project on St. Patrick's Day 2001, every single person who even moved a blade of grass was inside the big dome. No celebrities, nothing. They brought their families. There was nearly 4,000 of us. And it was really cheery because we did it. Everybody was proud of it. It was theirs. And that's part of the narrative, to do stuff that is intuitive, that is beautiful, that actually has a meaning because people worked together and did something brilliant. And it's not, it shouldn't be written about as hippie shit. It's the way the world should be, rather than isn't the alternative. I haven't got a minute's time for alternative, because the truth without alternative is so good anyway, if you actually behave honorably. That's my lesson for the day, ladies and gentlemen. Be trusting. Because actually, if someone messes you up in love, does that mean you're not going to fall in love again? Yeah, it's rare, all this. Anyway, the Eden Project opened on St. Patrick's Day. Since then, we've had 13.5 million people come to Eden. We have put over £1.2 billion into the Cornish economy. We run Eden as a social enterprise, but we run it according to the way I'm talking about. We have 2,400 local suppliers. We are like Attila the Hun with local supply. But that's not hippie shit, it's actually mafia. The way you do it is if you get local people, if everybody has got a stake in what you do, they want you to live a long and happy life. And it then stops where you live hemorrhaging. I have 700 staff, I've never managed anybody in my life. My chairman said to me, Tim, you've got to stop running this big project like a gang leader. I said, why? He said, because it will fail. You've got no corporate governance at all, you haven't even got any KPIs. And I said, what are they? And he said, damn it, man, one of us is going to have to go if this doesn't work out. And I said, I'm going to really sorry to lose you. I haven't quite understood the threat in his voice. So, over one long weekend, we've got 1 minute left, yeah? Over one long weekend, I wrote the management rules of the Eden Project. They're called the monkey business. There are 9 rules. Number one is you're not allowed to start work at Eden unless you say good morning to 20 people. That's not a strange religion. It could be 7 if you only got 7 people. The idea is don't start work by working. That's stupid. Communication takes place, by the way. Number two, you've got to read 2 books that everybody that knows you knows is outside of your normal sphere of interest, and review them for your colleagues. Rules number 3, 4, and 5, go and see a movie, a play, and a concert. Same rules as number 2. Rule number 6, you've got to make a speech once a year about why you love to work for me. If you can't do it, you must resign. That isn't crazy because it's not about me, it's about the fact that most people are dishonest about what makes them unhappy. So if they know you're going to make a speech about what makes you happy, you'll make damn sure, because you don't want to resign, you're brave enough to address the things that don't make you, that make you unhappy, so that by the time you make the speech, you're happy. Rule number 7, I don't have the comfort of religion, but I am very, very superstitious. I believe if you have good fortune and you do not share it with others, you will not only lose it, it will never return to you. You prove yourself unworthy of having it. So my top 80 team members, I have to conduct 1 act of guerrilla goodwill a year. You must do something unspeakably nice to someone who does not know you, who will never know it was you that did it. It's very cool. Rule number 8. Is it 8? You've got to prepare a meal for the 40 people who make it worth getting up in the morning to go to work. We've shut that down a little bit because some of my colleagues there, cooking is a bit health and safety issue. But anybody who thinks that the breaking of bread is about eating is not a human being. Almost every single major decision we made at Eden, ranging from doing Live Aids to the Sexy Green Car Show to the Big Lunch, which we're now doing, which is June the 3rd, by the way, this year, get out on the streets and have lunch, has come by working by wine light at night. We do it all the time. Because at night, people bring complete person to the table. During the day, they bring daytime person. And they're usually useless. You don't want those. Anyway, the last thing is all my team, all 700, have to learn to play samba drums. And you think, oh my god, you're so hippie, and now you're being hippie. This isn't hippie. One of the problems is most people do not understand optimism. They know how to write the words and spell it, but they don't actually understand it. Samba is difficult. It's also fucking expensive, you have to buy the drums. 10 drum captains, 70 people each, the Sulu, boom, 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 kabasa, timbales, rakakakakaka, congas, yeah, drum captain teaches them for half a day. We all get together in a room about the size of this. Main drum captain goes, ha! 70 people with surdos, boom, 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 boom. Their little veins swear, they're so tense, they're British. Then you have the kabasas come in, then the timbales come in, right? So the timbales come in, and suddenly the guys are on the surdos. You see their little asses moving, going, funny kids. Very odd. Now, as you go down the line, you can feel the tension growing. You can cut the tension out of your knife, and you get to the tension, the cowbell going, suddenly they go bonkers. Because they've realised something really amazing. Almost every child that was ever born, fortunately born, between the age of 2 and 6, naturally has to sing and dance. And they've suddenly discovered their liberation again, and the hair stands up on the back of their necks, and they realise that the sum of all our parts can be magnificently bigger than the sum. It can be enormous. Yeah. And when you know that, you can understand optimism, and you can understand its close cousin hope, because you realise that Homo sap is a very clever little creature. And if we're all going to fry, because we fuck up the planet, we deserve it. But what a wonderful time to be living, that we're being given a challenge worth rising to prove whether we were worth the name we gave ourselves, or was it a wonderful joke? So thank you for listening to me. Bye.